This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week are Richard Hawes.
Hello, everyone.
Stephen Lockridge.
Hello.
And blast from the past, it's Will Bentley.
Hiya.
Yay, there he is. In this week's show, we're going to kick off with the Ruby Rose and Morgan Freeman movie Vanquish. Then we got a bit of Frank Grillo in No Man's Land. Then we got a bit of Lance Henriksen in A Reckoning. Then we're off to India for Behind the Trees. Our short shot this week is a film called Oasis. And then we're going to join Christopher Lambert in a futuristic version of Beowulf. So without further ado, let's crack on. Our first review then is Vanquish. Ruby Rose stars as Victoria, a courier trying to put her past behind her, working for retired cop Damon. However, Damon forces Victoria to do his bidding by holding her daughter hostage. Okay, it's taken a while for this film to reach the UK shores, guys. So there's already been a lot of chatter about this film and quite a bit of negativity in some of the reviews. And I can see where a lot of those reviews are coming from. I think some of the direction here is bloody awful. I think some of the editing is bloody awful. I think some of some of the choices in this film are really, really bad. But what cannot be denied is that Ruby Rose is a natural badass, and she owns this film completely. Let's start with Steve.
yeah, I agree with Ruby Rose. I think she's real good in it. That's probably the main thing. Like I say, I didn't like the editing style at all. It's every shot kind of like blends into each other. There's no clear edits, if you know what I mean. It's very, very strange editing style. I mean, it kind of kicks off like that in the opening credits, where where it's giving you the backstory of Morgan Freeman. I was this supposed wonder cop and gone from a beat cop to being the chief commissioner or something, and then get shot outside his house and confined to a wheelchair. And it sets it up quite well with where it's going, and then all of a sudden he's in charge of these bent coppers that have AC-12 all over him, you know. And from there it reminded me of the one with Scott Atkins and Mario Van Peebles that we watched.
Seized,
you know, where that's the one where we'll kidnap your kid and make you do the job for us. And yeah, it just didn't really get any better. It was just her going in, shooting people, nicking the bag and running away.
I think it has the same issues that the Scott Adkins film had in that the bits of Ruby Rose doing these little mini mission things is great. But as soon as the focus goes away, you lose all interest in what's going on.
Yeah, it just goes flat. I mean, Morgan Freeman's, he's not even phoning it in. He's like ham radio in it. And he's just sat in the chair going, yeah, go pick the next one up. Even, you know, when she's supposedly in peril and he's watching her on you know, the live feed or whatever, he's like, yeah, get out of there. Run. No effort in it whatsoever.
Yeah, but I kind of disagree with you there a little bit, because I thought there was a bit of chemistry between the two of them, even over that sort of intercom. And anything beyond that sort of cadence just wouldn't sound like Morgan Freeman. It would be like Samuel L. Jackson or someone. You know, you don't expect Morgan Freeman to yell or get emotional, really.
Well, yeah, that's what I wanted, you know. Like you say, it's like a flat line delivery. It's just, you know, like you say, when they're together, I think that there is a chemistry there and it does work, you know, like a father-mentor figure type thing.
Yeah.
But once he's on the headset, it just fell flat.
Mm-hmm. Rich, did this hold any joy for you at all?
Not really. I mean, I found it very interesting from a bad movie standpoint, I'll be honest, because I think, you know, there's a few films we watched this week, but this is the one I took the most notes on. Mm-hmm. There's the most things that are interesting or bad about it to say, I would say. The first thing that struck me was that it's Morgan Freeman top billed. I was thinking, oh, okay, so what's going to happen here? And because I knew he was basically in the wheelchair for the whole movie and doesn't leave the house. So in a way, I think that was fair enough, because they do spend enough time with his character and they do cut back and forth to him while it's Ruby Rose doing the heavy lifting of the action stuff. Mm. So I think they've struck a nice balance there. We talked about the Virtuoso a few weeks ago, where Anthony Hopkins, who's the same age as Morgan Freeman, just popped in for a couple of scenes. He has like one big scene and then he disappears, but he was credited as he wasn't top credited. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this one, which is probably the ultimate sit down role ever, as in all he has to do is sit in a wheelchair in a house by himself for the most part. It's almost on par with Steven Seagal in Sniper Special Ops. Yep. But there is more exchanges and stuff going on. So, I mean, that's the other thing about the house that he's in, it's very grand and sort of opulent, but also very cold devoid of, I mean, the fact that the whole film has this color scheme and they try and, you know, use the colors and that to liven up the house, it just doesn't work. Mm. So moving on to the colour scheme. So what we've basically got here is an attempt at Jane Wick. So they're using, really garish greens and really bold reds to sort of overlay all the scenes. So she goes to meet one bunch of guys. It's all red. She's in one place. It's all blue. She's racing down the street on a motorbike. It's all really, really... really lime green and stuff like that. And at one point I actually turned down the color and I was thinking, what if I watched this in black and white, you know, what would that be like? And I did that for a little bit, the same as what you guys were saying about the editing, I don't think those over stylized elements to try and compensate for the low budget work at all. No. I mean, there's some crazy jump cuts, like really weird, really weird stylistic type. And then you've got the bit where she's on the coke and they sort of zoom in on her eyeball and all this sort of stuff, which I'm sure I've seen somewhere else. And then he's got the audacity to throw in a flock of birds in slow motion and stuff like that, wearing his influencers on his sleeves. Seized is a good call, because I hadn't thought of that one. It is basically...
Really? That was the most obvious.
No, you're absolutely right. But what I was thinking was this was a movie where it was about, you know, somebody telling the lead character to go places and do things, which the one that came to mind for me, and, you know, didn't really have much of a semblance of a plot, which brought to mind Mechanic Resurrection with Jason Statham.
Oh, yeah.
Which was a film of sequences, of set pieces, which didn't feel like it had a story. It was just like, you're going to go and do this now, and now you're going to go and do this. and it's that whole, the villain, and is he a bad guy, or is, you know... It's the same with Seized, really, you know. He's the bad guy, but is he a bad guy? Oh, I don't know. Let's sort of work it out amongst ourselves. Anyway, you've got that kind of transporter thing. Why does her motorbike sound like the Batpod?
I thought it sounded like the like the motorbikes in Tron.
Yeah, or Transformers. Or Hobbs and Shaw with Idris Elba's Transformers motorbike thing that he rides. Yeah. Why does it make all those sounds?
I was wondering if it was like an electric motorbike or something, but it doesn't explain or anything. It's just got this weird noise.
I thought it was a pretty neat bike, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a nice bike, but the sound's a bit weird. One thing we haven't mentioned is that Morgan Freeman, his character, Damon, is in pretty much every scene with Ruby Rose by virtue of a camera that Ruby Rose is wearing. Mm-hmm. On her. Yep. And I was just thinking, why would all these really, you know, really bad, you know, the really bad people who they're going out to meet, why would they even tolerate being filmed? Why would you? You're just gathering evidence and stuff. You know, everything should be, you know, on the QT. You know, I know it's not in his, but you know, how much can you trust him? You know, he's an ex-cop and everything after all. But
not only that, but why are these body cams so crap? It's like every time you see the footage, it's like it's glitching and there's like, you know, distortion. You think, are they just doing that to remind you that it's a body cam? You know, it's a,
they
you
are
looking at it through the camera.
Yeah.
You know, which I think everyone's pretty much set takes these days.
I mean, I was wondering whether if that's his normal thing, you know, because she's only doing this as a one off, so maybe.
Yeah, so you had the
no, yeah, yeah,
all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
I don't know. It just seems weirdly big. I mean, you know, you can get GoPros that are a hell of a lot smaller than that nowadays, and it's just like a big, massive thing on a lapel.
Yeah,
which you know, I presume.
It might be cop issue.
To know it's there, you know, to know it's there or whatever. But also as well, I thought the like the B plot with getting uncovered by the feds or whatever, all these crooked cops and stuff, and
the side story, yeah,
yeah. It just didn't seem to go anywhere really.
No, that's the thing. I mean, this film is really simple, but also really confusing because I don't really understand what was happening, or you know what, I wasn't really following the motivation behind all the events and what those guys were talking about and trying to cover it. I know it was all because it starts out with a close-up of a rat and then you see a guy who's gathering, you know, he's going to go to the cops and stuff, he's got a tape or something, so it's all about this guy. He'd been gathering this information that he was going to share with the FBI or whoever, and they're trying to cover it up and protect their asses. And so the way they do that is by he sends someone out with a camera to film more footage. I don't know, so that's all going on. I've got a few other notes, but I'm gonna shut up for a minute and let's see what Will has to say.
What does Will have to say about this one?
I've got a, you know, the first time I felt like chiming in was to say exactly that. I really just didn't know what his motivation was, because he was in confession with the Catholic Church at the beginning, and that was another thing. They did that weird kind of screen effect where it was like a really long shot of the church, but it made it look like a miniature, made it look like a little model. You know when they do that sometimes, like when they sort of weird film effect where it makes like perfectly normal buildings that they filmed look like miniature models. Anyway. He was there talking to them, doing his confession. And, you know, the priest is telling him about how the crooked cop business is going. And it's like, oh, right, so he's actually, is he a crooked cop? Or is this where he got his information on crooked cops? And then it obviously can apparent that he is a crooked cop. But then he's also going, oh, my caretaker's having problems with a daughter. I want to help her. Is this helping her? I mean, you know, putting her in constant peril for the, you know, it's just, I couldn't tell what he was trying to do. Was he having second thoughts about being a crooked cop the whole time and trying to make up for it? Or was he trying to get all his money? Well, I just didn't get it. I did not get it.
I personally, I think he's trying to get the money because obviously the little girl's ill. And I don't really want to go into spoilers, but I think he's trying to gather the money that he's owed to get it all in and then pass it on because it's all collapsing around him.
Yeah.
You know,
well, clearly.
But,
I mean,
he's
pieces, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
So one character we haven't mentioned yet, or one actor we haven't mentioned, is Patrick Muldoon.
I didn't recognize him for the first few scenes because obviously it's been, I mean, I haven't watched him in anything for like, five or ten years.
It's been 22 years since Starship Troopers.
Yeah,
you know, but yeah, he was the pilot in Starship Troopers. He turns up here as a shady FBI agent. He looks like he's been styled on John Travolta in Pulp Fiction.
That's where he's from. I meant to look him up. I'm like, yeah. I recognize him. I can't think where he's from. That's yeah. it.
Starship Troopers.
Jesus.
In fact, I think I've only ever seen him in one other film, and that was something called Black Cat Run.
Oh, yeah, yeah, with Jake Busey.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, he's Muldoon's not one of my favorites. He's kind of, he's not been one of my favorites, but he has had quite a reasonable run as both a leading man and a character actor and stuff. But I've never, things like Chain of Command with Roy Scheider. All that right. was one of his action leads. That was after Starship Troopers and stuff. But, you know, he's done various bits and bobs, but I've never really warmed to him particularly. But this was quite an interesting character role for him.
Yeah.
I didn't mind him in it, but it was because it was all part of that, you know, talking for the sake of talking kind of.
It went nowhere.
You know, pointless scenes. Yeah,
it was unfortunately just padding.
Padding. Yeah, exactly.
So, a couple of things. I mean, the opening credits that we mentioned about the so you got this montage of sort of Morgan Freeman's character's career as a cop. You know, so the idea is that when you find out he's actually a crooked cop, it's supposed to be a shock. It's not a shock, and it's completely superfluous. You don't need all that information. It's a guy in a wheelchair being looked after. You know,
he's got a whole wall of commendations that they made up for as well as props.
Exactly. I mean, there are shortcuts he could have done.
Can I just backtrack on that montage of newspaper clippings? Did you happen to notice that on one of them, the top story is about Morgan Freeman's character, Damon Hickey, but the bottom part is about the director of this film having having his next film nominated for 15 Academy Awards? And because I wasn't sure if it was a real film. It said The Comeback Trail, nominated for 15 Academy Awards, and how George Gallo and his wife are really excited to be going to the Academy Awards and whatnot. And I looked up the film, and it said starring Robert De Niro and stuff. And it is actually the film he made around the same time as this one.
All right.
So that can't be. He can't be that taken that seriously. So I thought that was quite funny. I had to pause it and just read it. But
he gets points for that one. Okay.
Yeah.
nice little cheeky Easter egg. But there was just these crappy little bits. I mean, you know, you mentioned the doves earlier. There's another bit where it's like this overlay of a snake, and it's like, okay, so are we going to see a snake in this film? No, do we not see a snake in this film at all? You know, it's like, well, what the fuck is the relevance of a snake being in the credits at all?
It's metaphoric. He's the snake, isn't he?
He's the snake, maybe.
He's a slippery customer.
Did anyone notice the scene where the crooked cops are like beating up the guy who's like, obviously the FBI plant or whatever? And you said you were talking about the rats earlier. Did anyone notice that that scene was filmed from the rat's eye view? That's why it's slightly distorted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was so weird because it kept showing the rats, and then it showed kind of like them looking at him getting beaten up in the corner.
Yeah,
but why?
There's loads of. I mean, I have to give it some, you know, credit for that. The craziness of some of the ideas and stuff that they're trying in this, it's borderline experimental if it wasn't so derivative.
There are some, you know, there are some other ways they could have done this. You know, has any of you guys ever play a game called Max Payne?
No.
I've only seen the movies.
So there's basically, you get, you know, at the end of each sort of chapter in the game, you know, to get to the next chapter, you've got to go through this nightmare sequence where you've got to sort of like walk this weird, you're in a sort of darkened maze, and you've got to follow this blood trail. And all the time you're doing it, you can hear your wife and your baby screaming as you're going. The bits when she's on the motorbike and she keeps getting flashes of her daughter going, "Mommy, save me." That's what it reminded me of. These fucking horrible scenes of tediousness of trying to get to the next chapter. It was like, so annoying. But, you know, that aside, as I said earlier at the top of the review, I thought Ruby Rose was great in this. I thought, you know, you could tell her character was in her element when she's in these sort of very confrontational situations. You know, when she goes to the drug dealer's place and they're sort of like trying to stall her and stuff, and you've got that guy called Biggie Smalls You know, you can tell that, you know, she is the person in control in that room. You know, those sort of scenes, I absolutely loved them, and I thought she nailed it. It's just, you know, that it was stuff like that that made the film relatively entertaining, it, for, despite its flaws, which are many. You know, I got through it. And I was looking, you know, as I said, I had to watch it in two halves. So I was looking forward to, you know, getting back to it and finishing it off. So
I will say I did. I really liked her headshots.
Yes.
I thought they were actually really well done, because she basically shoots everyone in the head.
Basically.
And she wears the two guns holster thing on her back, which is kind of a sort of signature.
Supported by Nick Cage and others.
Like Face Off and stuff.
Face Off, yeah.
Yeah.
And she's got Duke's jacket from Bit.
Now, the jacket. Okay, so when we first meet her at 14 minutes into the film, she is introduced as Damon's carer.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So what carer turns up for work wearing a really, really fancy white leather jacket, which they don't take off, with her daughter in tow, and proceeds to go to the kitchen and just sort of delicately cut up vegetables, all while wearing this jacket? She doesn't look like she's there to be a carer. Does she? It just looks ridiculous. I mean, no. She doesn't look convincing as a carer in any way, shape, or form.
No, that's true. I'll give you that.
They've not really thought it through. No, but also, you know, it's just not professional. You don't bring your kid to work, do you? I mean, you know, that's just not.
Well, I got the impression she was a live-in. They were actually living there.
Well, I don't know. It seemed like she was just sort of. She was just turning up for work to make him dinner and stuff at that point.
He has enough room in his enormous mansion.
I'm sure he's got servants' quarters. Yeah.
Mm. Oh, okay. Another thing. Yeah. How annoying was Morgan Freeman's phone?
It kept that ringtone. That piano ringtone.
That was another thing that really bugged me. It kind of changed later because a bit like in The Virtuoso, he answers the phone from different people. So he's got different phones with different ringtones, so you know who he's talking to and whatever. But this one with Victoria, Ruby Rose's character, it seems to be going off all the time. I think it was her character he was talking to at that point. But yeah, that was driving me mad.
Yeah, it was very annoying. One little shout out, the music actually got better as it went on. Towards the end, I was actually getting into the score quite a bit. I thought it was not bad at all. So there you go.
Oh, okay. Here's another thing. At times, the film kind of goes into this fairy tale sort of. I mean, I know it's got that heightened style and it's doing the whole John Wick kind of, you know, heightened reality stuff, but it almost feels, you know, because there's like, it's open season on Victoria now. She's back in the game, you know. they're all gunning for her now. But the, do you remember Running Scared, the Wayne Kramer film?
Paul Walker? Yeah, so there's Paul Walker,
yeah. So there's certain scenes in this that have that kind of fairy tale, you know, exaggerated cartoonish feel. Yeah, and I'm thinking specifically of when she goes to meet the gay drug dealer bloke in the turquoise suit and the mustache. It's just so overly camp, that's, you know, the scenes like that. It's just the film just seems to veer all over the place in terms of what it's doing. But say it's bad, but at the same time I love the fact that we can talk so much about it because of these things it's trying to do.
I don't think it's a good film at all, but I think Ruby Rose does a good job with bad material.
She's got her own accent in this one as well.
She has, yeah. She's Australian, which is a bit bizarre as well. but yeah, and I liked the sort of, you know, the bit of a sort of dodgy backstory for her character as well. I thought that was, you know.
She's supposed to be a Russian drugs courier, isn't she?
Basically, that. Yeah, well, her and her brother were sort of ripping off sort of various couriers and things like that, apparently. So, which is really cool. Anyway, scores on the doors for Vanquish. I'll kick off. I'm giving this a 6 out of 10. Rich?
I will give it a 6 out of 10. It reminded it's a bad film in the way of similar to Wake of Death. I felt there were a lot of similarities with Wake of Death. I kind of enjoyed this one a bit more, even though it doesn't have the big action sequences that, you know, there's a couple of those in Wake of Death. But yeah, it's worth seeing. It's too interesting as a bad film not to give any less than a 6, I'd say.
Yeah. Steve?
Yeah, I'll go with a 6 on this one.
And Will? Will?
Sorry, chaps, I keep forgetting to press speak. Yeah, it was a film, and you know, it had all the values and stuff. It was just too weird, really, to give any more than a 6 to.
Okay. 4 6s for Vanquish. Go check it out. Our next review is No Man's Land. When a vigilante border patrol turns fatal, a man flees on horseback to Mexico, seeking forgiveness from the victim's father. Let's go straight over to Steve on this one.
This was a slog, to be honest. I had a look, it's 2 hours, and then read the synopsis for this one, and I put it on, and it took me so long to get through. I don't know what kind of thing it's trying to tell, in a way. It's kind of like a Mexican illegal immigrant tale in reverse, where he American goes over to Mexico to, it's like he's trying to get forgiveness for killing this child, or, you know, that's not a spoiler, that's the first 10 minutes, but it takes him so bloody long to get there, and, you know, he's working illegally on a farm and then on the run from this drug dealer who's a cousin of the child's dad who's trying to kill him, and it was very, very bogged down. I mean, performances were quite good, and it looks, some of the shots are beautiful, but it was just too cliched and dragged like a seal's bollocks, to be fair. It was really, really just didn't grab me at all.
Rich?
I felt more favourably about it. I actually quite liked it. It's a modern day Western, or at least, you know, there are Western inflections. You know, we've got the grand landscapes, we've got the horse riding, we've got the cowboy hats and stuff. It's, you know, cowboy runs from the police after accidentally killing a boy, so he runs off into Mexico, and it's the film is following his journey, and it's kind of a coming of age tale in a way. I mean, he was at the start of the film, he's going to leave the ranch. He's got like a bright future ahead of him, like playing baseball, but he's not sure whether to leave. And then, you know, stuff happens, you know, his life gets thrown in a completely different direction. He's sympathetic, but he carries the guilt and stuff, but there's the revenge plot of the father of the boy that he shoots, who's the guy who's leading the immigrants across, trying to lead them across the border. His vengeance is kind of the secondary story, which I found quite interesting, because most movies like this are about the victims, the grieved trying to get revenge, and in this one it's all about the perpetrator, and you know, our sympathies, that they're trying to keep our sympathies with the perpetrator and hope that he doesn't get killed in retribution. I thought it was quite well played. Is it fair to put it in, you know, the ball all the way in the white boy, the white boy kills the Mexican, spending all our time with him rather than the thing. So I don't know. You can question its politics and stuff. I like George Lopez as Ramirez, the Border Patrol officer who is Mexican or has that sort of heritage, but he doesn't speak Spanish or anything. So that was quite good, because he's like, well, he's as American as anybody else there. So when he goes to Mexico, he's actually a bit lost. He's as lost as Jackson Greer, the main character, is. So he's kind of looking for Jackson keeps getting away from him like all the time, and everyone else. He gets away really easily, but I didn't mind it. Frank Grillo's in there as his dad. We see him everyone once in a while. Frank Grillo's always good value. You know, he could do this. I think he could do this character in his sleep. You know, it's just so, you know, he's just got that weathered, you know, cool, you know, cowboy kind of thing about him. Andy McDowell, though, was quite a surprise. She's playing Grillo's wife and Jackson's mother. But yeah, the role, there's not really a huge amount for her to do in this. But yeah, I think it's fine. It's interesting. I think people will like it. I think there's not really much more to say about it than that.
Mm. What do you make of Andy McDowell's accent?
I didn't mind it. Wasn't bothered.
Didn't jump out at me. Well, the first line she says in the film, it sounded really bad. It was almost up there with "Is it raining?" I hadn't noticed. It's a weird film, really. You mentioned it's politics, or what it could be. I mean, it's like, well, what are you trying to say here? But you build this character up, Jackson Greer. You know, he's going to New York to be in, you know, Major League Baseball because he's a star pitcher and all this sort of stuff. And oh no, you know, his future is in jeopardy because of this one little accident where he accidentally shot somebody. Oh dear!
If they weren't over, if it wasn't for those immigrants coming across their land,
you know, bloody libtards want to chuck away the key and, you know, lock him up. He can't help the fact that the guy runs away. He refuses to accept responsibility to begin with. You know, obviously he goes on this sort of journey of discovery and seeks forgiveness, and then at the end of the film he's like, well, yeah, this is kind of what I deserve. It's a weird sort of setup.
See, I wouldn't say he runs away to get, because he wants to admit to it, but his dad's not letting him. You know, his dad's like, I'll take the blame, because I don't want you cocking up your life if you're going to the Yankees. And he kind of runs away just because, I think he runs away to put the blame on himself, if you know what I mean, to take it away from his dad.
All right. Yeah, I can buy that.
You know what I mean?
I can buy that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this did nothing for me. This is like movie of the week on, you know, a TV movie thing. Mm. It's so political. You know, it's like, oh, you know, so I imagine the shoe was on the other foot, you know, and so you had to go across to Mexico and be a refugee. You know, how ironic
we've,
that.
We've seen that before, though, haven't we? I'm sure we've seen variations on that.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Now, interesting, the director of this, Connor Allen, I was just looking at his film. He's made a few films, but the one that jumped out at me, which you might have seen, Mike, is called Java Heat with Kellan Lutz and Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed that, actually.
Everything else is quite forgettable, disposable, doesn't really have anyone, you know, notable in the cast apart from this one that I can see. But yeah, that one sort of I was like, oh, he did that, that's weird. But he seems to do stuff like, you know, he did like one on Netflix that was called Walk Ride Rodeo, so he's like got this thing for like movies about horses and stuff like that. I tell you what, there's some beautiful horses in this movie. I mean, the main guy, Jackson, I'm not sure if it's his horse or what, but it's like what, brown and white, just amazing. Look, you know, incredible looking horse. I'm not an equestrian sort of guy at all, but I thought, wow, they really got some you know, some nice animals involved in this movie. You know, nice, you know, adds to the aesthetic. You know, it's very nicely shot, lovely landscapes and stuff, and you know, costume designs and everything, all really good. But yeah, Yeah. So, you know, come for Grillo, stay for some drama about forgiveness.
Yeah.
It's... Oh, I did really like the guy, you know, the bad guy who he whips and, you know, and, you know, he tears his face up. So he's out for revenge, basically, because he showed him up. The sort of white, trashy sort of bloke with the bleached hair and everything. Yeah. I liked him. I thought he was good.
No, he did my fucking head in. I'm sorry, he really did. I just couldn't stand him.
The one thing I thought was, how does he keep turning up everywhere? He keeps just finding him all over the place. It's like the guy's wearing a tracking device or something. I don't know. But the I didn't like it. I like the performances in the film. I like the dad. I haven't really mentioned him. I think it's Gustavo Jorge Jimenez. Mm-hmm. He was good. But again, his character needed more emphasis, I think. You're too much in Jackson's side of this. It should be a two-part thing.
That's
it. Yeah. Yeah, but anyway. having said that, what more could he do? You know, all he's got to do, really, is grieve his son. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not expecting the guy to turn up until Knobhead with blonde hair tells him that he has.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the last thing you're going to expect, isn't it? This guy's going to sort of hop across the border. Anyway, okay, scores on the doors, Steve?
A five.
Rich?
I'll give it a very reasonable 7.
I'm splitting the difference. I didn't enjoy it, but I have to give credit where it's due to the technical side of it. It's well acted. It's just not my kind of story at all. So I'm giving it a 6 out of 10. So that's a 5, a 6, and a 7 for No Man's Land. Go check it out. Our next review is A Reckoning. After her husband is brutally murdered, a widowed homesteader seeks revenge and leaves everything behind to hunt down his killer. Okay, so I must admit, I've only seen the first sort of 20 to 30 minutes of this. I was quite enjoying the aesthetic of it. And nice to see Lance Henriksen, obviously. But I'll be interested to hear what you guys have to say about it. So let's start with Rich.
Yeah, I think that opening 20 minutes, the aesthetic you mentioned there, that is consistent throughout the whole movie. It doesn't really change beyond that. I mean, the film has a certain pace. Mm. It's very much about the atmosphere. It's a low budget film, but it knows how to use its budget quite well, I think, in terms of the emphasis on the visual, the location shoots. You know, the locations that they've used are, you know, for the kind of environment that they are in, they're quite spectacular. Into the beauty, the way they've got the colors and everything is really nice. The composition, there's definitely, there's some really careful attention to some of the composition in the shots. It is a slow burn. It's quite an interesting counterpoint to what we were talking about with No Man's Land. This is a pure, a proper Western. Mm-hmm. From the more traditional point of view of the wronged person, in this case a woman. Well, it's not the first time that we've seen a female led Western. Obviously, we've got Quick and Dead, and there's loads of other stuff, including revenge tales. But what kind of separate makes this one stand out to me is that pace. It's not like, basically, not a lot happens. It's following her slowly. She doesn't really have many lines. She has a few encounters with some people, and then it gradually leads to a showdown, a conclusion where there's with this crazy guy who basically delivers a monologue to a skull in I guess what is supposed to be a nod to Shakespeare or something. But it is all, some of the costumes and everything, there's some lovely attention to detail here. It's not really my cup of tea, and I wasn't really paying a huge amount of attention to it because of the pace. It's about an hour and 15 minutes long, but it's a really nicely shot film, but you've got to have a bit of patience with it, I think.
Steve, did you get on with this one at all?
Like we were saying before we started, it's not been a great week, really. it is slow. It's kind of like Lord of the Rings, where she's just walking, basically, and bumping into people.
Yep.
Yeah, isn't it? there's no other thing it can be. It comes across a couple of bounty hunters who are like, this is our bounty, not don't you be coming after him. You shouldn't be doing this because you're a woman. And, you know, and then she bumps into a nice guy. She's where he runs this shop, basically, or shack where she stays for the night. And then she bumps into the guy who she thinks it is, because there's no real evidence that it's him. He's just nuts. And she's been told that the guy who's killed her husband has done another couple of killings. He's obviously nuts. And the hint that he's been raised by cannibals or something. And it just kind of peters out, really. Some of the acting is awful, especially the guy at the end, the nut job or whatever he is.
He's giving it his all, though, isn't he?
he's
going to town on that role.
Yeah, yeah, but it's not. It's not Nicolas Cage doing it, you know what I mean?
Now that would have been good.
Yeah, exactly, something like that. But it's like you say, it's beautiful to look at. It, you know, the locations they've used are absolutely gorgeous. There's no denying that, but it is just, let's walk through these beautiful locations and then fire a couple of guns, because there's no really building of character with her, really. She doesn't, like Rich said, she's hardly got any lines, you know. And yeah, it's just there, basically.
So I wanted to just take a little bit of issue with the way it's marketed in the UK. So the cover, the poster designs for, you know, the US release, there's a series of posters, all of which are very, very nicely designed and emphasize the, you know, the heroine of the story.
Yep.
And as well as the supporting cast. What we get in the UK is completely misrepresentative, because they isolate a shot of a man holding a gun and they put it on its blue background. And so they just try to make it look like this generic Western about a man with a gun. they did this before with, I think, I can't remember the name of the title, but there was a film came out a year or two ago, which was another movie that was about a female character. Yeah. And they just completely tried to hide it. Mm. And that was just, which I thought was a bit ridiculous, really. I think the cover emphasizes Lance Henriksen's involvement. He's in like one scene, I think, at the beginning. Good scene, because he gets to deliver quite a good monologue and that, but we don't see him again. And Meg Foster's in there. And I think I knew who Meg Foster was, but I didn't recognize her at the time. Her distinctive eyes were not, you know, drawing, you know, highlighting her to me. I don't know if her eyes have dimmed over the time or whatever, but she, what always stood out about Meg Foster in Project Shadow Chaser, or, you know, all that, the other stuff, yep, that they live, you know, stuff like that, was her very distinctive eyes. And in this one, I think she appears at the beginning, but that's it. She didn't stand out to me in any way. So they kind of play their aces quite early in the movie.
Yeah.
We kind of needed, you know, to build up to a Lance Henriksen rather than have the Lance Henriksen factor first, I guess. I don't know. But the cinematography by Justin Janovich is excellent.
So this was originally released in the US in 2018.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The director, Justin Lee, also did another film that year called Big Legend, which is a much better film. And I'd rather recommend that one over this. Where, you know, it's a Bigfoot movie, basically, but it is very good. And I don't think you'd think the same director was doing both films. Obviously had a better...
What were the aesthetics like in that one?
They're very good. Mm-hmm. It was set during the wintertime, you know, it's in the forest. But it worked really well. It's sort of basically two guys sort of stuck in the forest being hunted by a sort of Bigfoot. But it works really well. I really enjoyed that one.
Yeah, this guy, Justin Lee, he's done quite a few movies, including several Westerns, one called Badland, one another called Any Bullet Will Do.
Yep.
And yeah, he's I haven't seen any of his stuff before. I'm interested to see, you know, Big Legend or one of these other films and stuff. It's just this one, just there wasn't enough substance or drive to it for me. I wasn't expecting it to be such a slow burn.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, so guys, scores on the doors. Let's go with Rich.
I'm going to have to go a 6 again on this one.
Okay, and Steve?
Yeah, I'll go a 5 on this one.
I am going to abstain from voting on this one because I've only seen the first 20 minutes, so I need to be fair. So a 5 and a 6 for A Reckoning. Go check it out. Our next review is Behind the Trees. While on a romantic getaway in the Indian wilderness, a couple from Los Angeles accidentally witness the haunting exorcism of an 11-year-old girl, and they decide to rescue her. Oh my God, guys. Have you ever seen a film which calls itself a horror movie without anything actually happening in it whatsoever?
I think that's a bit unfair.
Do you think that's unfair?
I think so.
No, I don't.
Okay. I didn't get on with this at all. I found this a bit of a chore to watch. Is that the right word I'm looking for? Chore? Possibly.
Yeah.
There were a couple of little bits. I like the design of the woman with the straw mask. I thought that was interesting in the way that was used. But I found this. I watched a lot of a series on Netflix called Anjan. Have you come across that?
No.
Anjan. It's basically it's the Indian version of the X-Files.
Okay.
This couple, this sort of detectives, sort of searching all these supernatural stories. It is quite interesting, but it's very, very long. You know, sort of 100 episodes or something ridiculous like that. So I got a bit of flavour of that, you know, going into this. But I don't know, it just didn't really sort of grab me as a scary story at all. Rich, you say you got a bit more out of this, so let's hear your thoughts.
Well, I want to just sort of pick up on... I think this one has got one of the more interesting examples of in media res that we've seen.
Yeah, I'll
because
go with that.
Because it starts with a scene that it never really returns to until the very, very end.
Until almost the post-credit sequence.
Until the mid-credit scene. Yeah. So I was like confused when the film initially finished. I was like, "Well, hang on a minute. What happened to the? What about the people at the start? What was that? And then you have to wait because you know if you've turned off the film at the point that the credits start rolling, then you're going to miss that. So there's a whole like other bit. That happens after, but so that didn't click up quite as well. It's one of those stories about Americans going to an exotic exotic location it being full of scary people basically. It's very, you could say xenophobic. I don't know.
it's President George W. Bush era world politics.
Yeah.
Stay outside of the US at your peril.
Do you remember we watched Death of Me with Maggie Q while back? Yeah. This is basically the same film.
Yeah.
It's the same setup, but instead of Maggie Q, we've got Vanessa Curry of Nicaraguan. Heritage and her other half is Indian, so they go to India what is their reason for going? Do he wants to show her where he comes from?
Ostensibly he wants to propose to her, don't
they? They're taking like a trip to they don't go to where his family come from, but they go to somewhere in the region. They go to like a resort and stuff. So the Indian location itself makes it quite interesting. I mean, the director is Indian. The setting is in India. A lot of the supporting cast is Indian. It gives it a very distinct identity. But of course, we've got an American in the lead, through whose eyes we see this. You know, the true colors of this scary Wicker Man type environment that she's found herself in. And of course, there's a creepy child who has to come into the mix.
Of course.
And she's like looking after her, whatever. You know, there's nothing we haven't seen in here like a million times, you know, in various versions. There's not a huge amount. I will side with you and say there's not a lot that's notable or interesting to say about it, apart from the things that I've just mentioned about, you know, the fact that it's a horror movie made in India. But, you know, the fact that, I mean, it's a horror movie set in India, made in India, with an actress whose last name is Curry. That's quite funny, right?
Yeah, sure. So this is one of those films where spooky shit happens to characters and they go, oh, you know, startled. And then somebody goes, what's wrong? And they just go, nothing. It's like, no, for fuck's sake, you just jumped a mile. What happened? It's I hate stuff like that. It's like bloody Amityville all over again.
Yeah, what was that scene where the guide, what's his name, Navi, sort of gets his knife out and goes, what's wrong with your neck?
Yeah.
That's all it was.
Yeah.
Like, what's wrong with your neck? And he's like, why? What the hell was that?
Yeah.
I thought there was going to be a bit more of a reaction to that than there actually was.
He didn't react. He was just like, oh, yeah, heat rash. It's like, what?
Yeah.
I did like that guy playing the...
he's pretty cool.
The guide, you know, he sort of guides him through and he explains about why they wear the masks. They wear these masks on the back of their heads, which has some quite creepy... I'm sure I've seen that. I'm sure that's got some sort of basis in...
Yeah. I think that is kind of true. That stuff. Yeah. But he goes, he sort of says, I'll never look back, you know, because that's where the spirits are or something. So naturally he looks back straight away, you know, but no.
No.
It didn't work for me at all, this one.
No. What about the box? You know, the box that they find and there's bum, 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 you know, because somebody's trapped inside.
Well, that was
quite atmospheric,
looping,
I thought.
That looping back to the beginning again, it didn't go anywhere really, though. You know what I mean?
No.
I mean, it loops back at the end, and that ending as well. You know, that mid-credit sequence, it just had me sort of going, "Huh? So everything's gonna be fine then?" Basically, unless he's a complete idiot, well, he might be, but you know, unless he can put like two and two together, you know, and come up with five. Then everything should be okay.
Yeah.
and that's how I imagine the film ends.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I agree with you, Mike. I thought it was terrible. It's supposedly a horror film where nothing scary happens. I didn't even, like Rich said, I didn't even think the supposedly ghosty character. I thought it just looked like some woman with a load of sticks on her head.
I didn't mind that. I thought, you know, that sort of reminded me of sort of other sort of folk, you know, folk supernatural kind of stuff. But
reminded me of The Village. Do you remember the Village?
Yeah,
the character.
Yeah.
But it wasn't scary. It didn't make. I think there was like one half decent jump scare, and basically all it is him walking past his door in his bedroom, and it doesn't do anything. He just walks past the room onto the balcony.
I don't find most horror movies actually scary at all or anything. No? So maybe I don't get that kind of rewarding, you know, result from, you know, just, it was like a Children of the Corn movie or something, you know, it's just.
Yeah, but there's no real tension built or anything. You look behind and you see this woman with sticks on it. That was it. I mean, the characters. Again, it's like, oh, we're Americans. We know what we're doing. We'll just take this kid and stick her in our hotel room. We won't tell anyone about it. We won't go to the police or anything like that. You know, I mean...
Yeah, you committed child abduction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, it's... And the guy, is he called Jay, I think?
Yeah.
It's such a wet lettuce. I'm sorry, but... He proposes to her. She turns him down. Then they find this kid and take her back to the room. The morning after, he's like, oh, I love you so much more because of what we've done and how you were. Oh, piss off. I mean, that's the only reason why she's a paediatrician. I've got to look after the child, and no, it was terrible. It really was. Even and like you say, I know we'll stick the actual ending in the credits.
I know.
Yeah, that's a pretty bad decision, I think.
Yeah,
because I think most people are just going to turn it off to basically literally as soon as it ends.
Yeah, exactly.
I think most will turn it off halfway through, I should think, but.
Oh dear!
Yeah, it just doesn't do anything. Mm. Even the the kid who's supposedly possessed, all she does is jump about a bit. Really, she just jumps about the bedroom and sits in a corner. Well, that's what my kids did when they were that age anyway. Well, younger, I suppose, but it's no different. It just baffled me. It really did baffle me how they think what they're doing is right. And
I think, Rich, we've covered some bona fide Indian horror movies before. I seem to remember.
We have, yeah.
And I think that's kind of what this is missing, is that sort of like full-fledged, you know, I mean, you know, there is a sort of campiness and a bit of cheesiness to them, but they, you know, there's a bit of gusto as well. And
heightened to it.
And I think that's what's missing here, you know, is trying to appeal to an American audience and just missing the mark, really.
Mm.
I think it needed a bit more madness to it rather than sort of this sort of very
sort subdued
of pedestrian sort of storyline, unfortunately. Okay, guys, so scores for this one. I think I'm going to have to give this one a 5 out of 10.
Yeah, Rich? I'll go with a 5.
Okay, Steve.
Sorry.
I'd say I liked it a lot more than you guys. I didn't like it as much as Death to Me, which I think is a superior version of this story. But 6 out of 10 from me.
Six and 2 5s. Will, what did you make of this one?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think I viewed it enough to give it a good shout. But like what I did see, I would say I would be generous giving it more than a 6. It was just miles too slow and. Yeah, it didn't hang together well enough to be anything more than.
It's a shame. We do like horror movies on this show.
I do, and this one didn't. Yeah. This one didn't grip. This one didn't.
Just didn't work. Didn't work for us.
No.
Okay, so we'll call that a charitable 6. So 2 6s and 2 5s for Behind the Trees. Go check it out if you're there. Our short shot this week is Oasis. In a desert landscape, a wanderer must fight for every drop of water he can uncover. Okay, Rich, this is a short film, 8 minutes at the most. Lovely widescreen photography in this one. A very bare-boned story, but I think they get away with it with some interesting props. And, you know, a nice little twist towards the end. So tell us a bit more about Oasis.
It's directed by David Wayne Smith, whose film Bad Hit we covered a while back.
Yeah.
That was an action movie. I wasn't sure quite what to expect going into this because it was billed as like a science fiction film. And it's kind of set in another world. Not quite clear. Certainly the physics or the, you know, the environment, you know, the way you access water is you know, things are fundamentally changed if it is our Earth. It's a markedly different to Bad Hit, but after this initial setup it does then become quite a good little action scene, like a fight sequence, which I wasn't expecting, so that was quite nice. And then it kind of moves back to the drama. And I found it quite I don't know if I'd say moving, but certainly along those lines. I thought it was very heartfelt and, you know, very affecting the way that the, I mean, it's something we've seen again before. You know, there's not a lot of original ideas. You know, there's not a lot you can do that's not been done before. But I thought the way they played it worked really well. I mean, there's little, you know, you could compare it to something like Waterworld or whatever. But, you know, the idea of this lone survivor confronted by an ethical choice. And I thought, you know, within 8 minutes, you know, the story covered, you know, the story covered a nice amount of ground. There was a good action sequence, very nicely shot, all set in this desert. So it's all sand, far as the eye can see.
So
a little bit of visual effects.
The director's South African, I believe, isn't he?
Yes, it's made in Cape Town. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I can very much imagine that was shot in the same place as the ending for Zulu that we covered the other week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Same sort of scenario. Not scenario, but you know what I mean. Same sort of location.
Yeah.
Steve, do you enjoy this one?
Yeah, it was okay. Like you say, nicely shot. I enjoyed the fight. You know, that little action scene, and then you get a little twist at the end, and then it's done. You know, it was okay. like I say, it's definitely more of a sci-fi twinge to Bad Hit that he's done previously. You know, the what's the word? This dystopian desert landscape. You know, where he's trying to find water just to keep going, and there's nothing else surrounding at all. And then all of a sudden this woman shows up out of nowhere and you're like, oh, where's she come from? And
yeah, that is a bit funny because she literally like magically appears.
yeah And then obviously, you know, you get the twist and the fight, and then kind of an obvious ending where it was going, but it does it well. You know, it's shot well. It's it's really, really nice little ending.
Will, over to you. What do you make of this one? Anytime you're ready, Will. You're on mute.
Sorry, guys. Yeah, I keep doing that. yeah,
it's like, actually, it's like every Zoom meeting at work.
Yeah, I'm no revisionist. Well, we use Teams, so. I mean, I'd have to say that. Firstly, it's the one film I actually managed to watch and, you know, be able to watch sort of completely fully without any, you know, interruptions and you know, take my time over because it was only 8 minutes long. the length of my attention span as well. So, and it as a short film, it was textbook, really, because it didn't overreach at all. And, you know, I mean, it was clever because it didn't use language, which is just, you know, I always think that's brilliant, you know, because it means two things. I mean, from the maker's point of view, it means that you can show it anywhere in the world. And, you know, from a technical point of view, it means that your actor's physical performances have to be shit hot. You know, everything has to be sort of really like well done. And it really was in this case, like all three of the cast members were spot on. You know, the main character, you know, from the start. I think the only thing that I was sort of thinking, his first fall down the dune just didn't seem that convincing, but that's literally it. If I had to sort of say there was anything about this film that I thought, it could have done a few more takes at that just to sort of, so I'm a bit more convinced that he actually lost his, you know, lost his footing because, but that was it. Like everything else, he was, you know, a man about to die of dehydration. You know, and these desperations clear at the start. It just everything that they did in it makes you start to imagine. Well, you know, exactly like you were saying at the start. What world is this? What's happened in the world? You know, your first thought is this the post greenhouse? You know, post climate change collapse? You know, did it actually take place in, you know, Fulham? But it's now a sort of arid desert. You know, what is the technology that he's using to find water? You know, how is it completely normal that's how you get water out? You know, what is that technology? Where's he come from? Where's he going to? Is he going anywhere? And, you know, that's what a good short film does, is it basically just sort of your imagination starts to go into overdrive because you're given just enough and the world is made, you know, in 8 minutes, it's made, it's not complete, but your imagination is scrabbling to try and complete it. Mm. And those performances between him and, you know, the woman and the child were ideal. I just thought it was a really, really well-made film, because you might think it's easy to make something narratively brilliant in 8 minutes, and it's not. To do it as succinctly as that is, I think, an achievement. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, that's a really well managed and well brilliantly produced little story, because I love sci-fi almost as much as I love horror. Mm. And I love sci-fi for all of those reasons, because you start trying to imagine everything else that's not said, you know, in an 8 minute film that's completely free of dialogue, you know, with just the sort of two props, three actors, and really tight kind of little narrative, you know, where you can see what they're thinking by their actions. It's great. I loved it. I thought it was excellent.
Yeah, and really the performers themselves are experienced stunt people as well, which also adds to the authenticity of their encounter as well.
Yeah, oh, the fight was fantastic. I mean, it really was. It was like, you know, it was utterly utterly convincing. You know, like from, but yeah, I just, you know, I'd have kept my footing on that dune. It wasn't that bloody steep, but you know, that's like my only gripe. And I'm just trying to find something to be objectively critical about. But no, that was I don't know these people as, you know, as well as you guys do, but that was a fight, and it was you know, exceptionally well fought, because there were people who would die if they didn't get that last drop of water.
We covered the director's previous film called Bad Hit, which we very much enjoyed. It's a really good action comedy. It's an action film with comedic moments.
Yes.
And that's worth checking out. If you go to we'll put the link to this film into the footnotes as we usually do, and I'm pretty sure you'll be able to find Bad Hit very quickly from there. So check out both if you haven't seen Bad Hit already. I totally agree with you guys. The only other thing I'd say, you know, about the characters, you know, you really feel their desperation. You know, Israel, you know, literally a sort of life or death situation they sort of find themselves in, but with a sort of, you know, ray of hope towards the end. Very good stuff. Please, please, please check it out. And while you're at it, why not check out the DTV Digest Short Shots podcast, where we look exclusively at short films. There's a few episodes up on the site. And also, don't forget to check out the Twitter page as well. Rich keeps posting a new short film every evening, so check that out as well. Our DTV throwback this week is Beowulf. In a besieged land, Beowulf must battle against the hideous creature Grendel and his vengeance-seeking mother. This stars Christopher Lambert in his most smouldering eyes. Also, Rona Mitra in there. He has, though. I mean, I watched... there's another film with him. I was watching Fortress. That was, you know, the Stuart Gordon one. Mm. And there's something about Christopher Lambert's stare. You know, when he sort of glares at somebody, it's the most intense thing ever. He's just so good at it, at scowling at people. And he's great in this thing. He really is. But I digress. Let's kick it over to Steve to begin with.
Yeah, wasn't a fan, to be honest. You might say he's got the smaller eyes, but he can't walk, to be fair.
He can somersault, though.
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, I'm going to go over to that corner of the room, but I won't walk. I will jump 15,000 times to get over there.
I'll do a dozen backflips.
Yeah. It didn't grab me. I mean, Rona Mitra, I thought, was really underserved as well. I've seen her in a few things, and I do like her. But, like, you look at the poster. Is she even mentioned on the poster?
Well, that's the thing. The UK VHS release, I don't think it ever came out on DVD, but the video came, the cover has her front and centre, but her name is nowhere to be seen. They give credit to Layla Roberts, who plays the Grendel's mother, yeah. I guess. Yeah. And she at that point, she was a Playboy playmate, and this was kind of a big role for her. Mm. And they credit her, and they credit One other person.
Patricia Vasquez, is it?
Oh, exactly. So Patricia Vasquez, who's only in the opening scene, but because I guess she was in The Mummy, you know, she got a credit. But poor Rona Mitra doesn't, you know, in her home territory, you know, she's, you know, English girl, you know, in a, you know, British release, she's front and center, but her name's nowhere to be seen. I thought that was, pretty bad, really. That must have been a bit quite gutting for her, I would have thought.
Well, maybe she didn't want it there. She probably saw it and thought, you know what, lads, yeah, leave it off. It don't matter. The monster again. You've got, as it comes out, you've got, it's like a weird distortion on the monster. Now, to me, it was like, is that just to stop it looking cheap and you can't see it properly? And
I think there's a bit of that.
It just didn't grab me. I thought it was overblown, a bit pants, and especially like, you know, the armorer. Mm-hmm. It was like he'd come in from 48 hours as trying to be Eddie Murphy or something like that. It just didn't work.
Well, this was made around, this was like 1999, so this was where, you know, the black comic relief character was rife, basically, throughout this whole all kind of period in filmmaking.
Indeed. Yeah.
But everyone else is trying to, like, you know, Shakespearean it up, and he's like, yo, what's up, bitches? And it's just, no, it just didn't work at all.
Well, the producer of this also produced Dungeons & Dragons. And I don't know if you remember, but they did exactly the same film thing with that, with, I think it was Marlon Wayans.
Marlon Wayans, isn't
it? They just added him in to do lots of comic relief kind of stuff.
I didn't bother with it, I'll be honest. But it's the same producer as Mortal Kombat as well, if I remember rightly. Which,
I think they're quite proud of that, aren't they, on the DVD cover and that things.
And the soundtrack as well. It's like they've ripped off Mortal Kombat. You've got this medieval set film, and you've got banging techno as a soundtrack.
Ah, but it's not medieval set though, is it?
I thought it was. To be fair, they're in a castle. There's not lasers or anything. They've just got.
No, it's more. It's more like it's mad. It's a Mad Max sort of dystopia.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, it's been sort of cobbled together from different sort of eras and things, isn't it? Yeah, because the whole thing with the actual castle, you can see it's like, you know, it's got a futuristic sort of element.
It's a bit steampunky, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Rich, what did you make of this? Had you seen it before?
Yeah, I saw it when it came out, but I haven't seen it since. There was a lot that was memorable about it then that, you know, was kicking up on, you know, so like the Steve has mentioned the Mortal Kombat thing already, but the movie opens with a Mortal Kombat style logo and soundtrack. So they're trying to make it. They keep pumping in this pretty bad techno music. There's some heavy metal and stuff in there as well. But they pump in this techno music to the action sequences and stuff, which doesn't really work. The whole film is kind of a hot mess. But I kind of like that about it. I mean, it was shot in Romania with a cast from all over the place. Some of them are speaking their natural accents, like Rona Mitra and Christopher Lambert, and others are dubbed, like Roger Sloman, who's got a, you know, a British English accent. He's been dubbed American for some reason, or whatever. I don't know why some of the choices were made. The thing about the Grendel monster, who's you know, a man in a suit, but it's got that blurry overlay that Steve was saying. I think there's two things that they've probably, that does disguise a bit of the maybe shortcomings with the suit. But from what I could see, the suit looked pretty good. I didn't mind it. I think that aesthetic worked quite well. One of the things, because when I'm watching it, I'm thinking of things like. I don't know, like, was it, could you even sort of put it with like Fist of the North Star or something? I don't know. But the aesthetic of it seemed from a direct, you know, like an Anthony Hickox or someone, or a you know, somebody might have done it. It was actually directed by Graham Baker. Now, the name didn't jump out to me. And so I looked it up.
He had
and it,
an interesting IMDb page.
He did Alien Nation.
I know, yeah.
Which is pretty amazing.
Final Conflict, the third Omen film.
Oh, I've never seen that one. Yeah, so quite a journeyman sort of career he's had.
And The Recruit.
What was The Recruit?
I know. That's not the one I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of The Rookie. Sorry. I saw that and I thought, oh. No, I was thinking The Rookie, you know, the Charlie Sheen, Clint Eastwood one.
All right.
I think Eastwood directed that.
He might have done. Yeah. Not in this best.
No, he did a film called Born to Ride with John Stamos in 1991 and then basically disappeared for 8 years before sort of coming up here. I think he's a British director from what I can tell. I mean, his last film was called, which was made, he didn't make another film after Beowulf until 2016, which is at the moment his last credit, which was called With Love from Suffolk. So, which is quite different, but I guess I mean he was born in 1938, so you know he's getting on. But the whole film's got this hodgepodge kind of thing going on with, you know, adding in elements from different time periods, and you know the weapons. I think the weapons that they designed for the film and that I think are pretty good. The bit where he Beowulf gets tooled up. And he holds up those two crossbow guns. It's pretty awesome. There's the outpost itself, you know, the sort of castle place, I think, you know, looks quite decent, although it's obviously like a CGI background thing that they've added in. One thing that really ruins it is at the end is the kind of Mummy Returns Scorpion King, you know, creature effects, which is all like really dodgy looking CGI with cutaways to close-ups of the actor, Layla Roberts in like the head makeup. But that's of the period. But I had a lot of fun with this.
I must admit, I had a lot of fun with this. I think some of it is a bit too repetitive. You know, there is a lot of padding in there. And I don't think they made enough of the dream sequences to make them really sort of make any sense. I was really confused as to who was in the dreams to begin with. You know, I thought it just wasn't sort of gelling properly. But as I said, you know, sort of Christopher Lambert, I thought, you know, he's a real sort of magnetic presence in this film. You know, you can't look away from him.
Or his white hair,
yeah. and his costume and his, you know, all the weapons and stuff. I think they did a good job of that. I mean, not so good with his, you know, marrying him up with a stunt double who's doing these backflips and all sorts. Because, you know, there isn't enough whimsy in the world to make me believe that Christopher Lambert is suddenly doing all these acrobatic ninja stuff. You know?
Yeah, well, that's the problem I had with Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger. You know, when they did that, and it was just, you know, the guy's just flying around all over the place, and I'm just thinking, no.
I don't remember him doing all that.
It didn't work in Eraser for me.
I have to have another look. I can't remember him doing any sort of acrobatic stuff.
Really. He was they were doing like some flippy stuff or whatever.
I now need to have a look.
But did you think, I mean, I was watching the film, so Layla Roberts turns up with a crimped hair and, you know, revealing clothing or whatever. She's quite glamorous and whatever, and she's doing these seductive scenes. And I just couldn't help but think of Ghostbusters, you know, the scene where Ray Sands.
that really dodgy scene, yeah.
Scene where, because it's, I think, Dan Aykroyd's wife playing that ghost who's getting intimate with him. Let's say the scene you never understood when you were a child and watched it, and you thought, "What's going on?"
Because originally that was going to be a longer sequence, wasn't it?
There's a whole thing. It was set in a different location or whatever. Anyway, that's what that reminded me of. But even her, you know, she doesn't have many credits to her name, Layla Roberts. I thought she suited this role quite well, and she did well with it. I mean, she had to put up with, you know, being the monster with the makeup and stuff at the end, and although they only show her head and that, I thought, you know, she made as much of it as she could, I thought. But Rhona Mitra gets rather underserved. She's quite a key supporting character. bit distracting. I don't know why that was. Why she couldn't keep her lips together. That was just jumping out at me as a thing that was happening. But she was fine. I liked the guy playing her dad, who's an actor I didn't recognize, but he was because he's kind of the king sort of character, I guess you would say. He's like the main guy there in the place. And Götz Otto as Roland, who is initially, you know, very jealous of the presence of Beowulf, and then comes to have a grudging respect for him, and, you know, sort of almost be a cheerleader for him as the movie goes on. I quite like, he was a Stamper in Tomorrow Never Dies, and he's done very something. Yeah, yeah. German actor.
Yeah, yeah.
So they got some good people involved in it, and I think it stands up. I think it's of its time, but
I was pleasantly surprised. I must admit that, especially that whole beginning sequence, in the forest and the village outside. I thought that was really cool. And just for a moment, I thought they were actually going to use that that machine.
They've got like a guillotine that's basically a giant straight razor.
From a
bar.
Yeah.
it's a giant razor.
It's a bit bizarre, but I thought we were going to have a moment like in that film Mind Warp. Have you seen that one?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
All right, okay. Yeah, well, yeah, it's a gruesome moment in there. We actually sort of follow through with their threats. But I was pleasantly surprised with a lot of this. I thought it was a lot better than I was expecting, I must admit. So I was kind of kicking myself thinking, this is another one of those films I wish I'd seen when it came out.
I think there's a little touch of Ken Russell madness about it.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Okay, well, we don't score the DTV throwbacks, but we do recommend you check them out. This is currently available on Amazon Prime. We don't know how long for. The Amazon Prime can be a bit funny sometimes with its films that it has in its back catalogue. You know, 1 minute it's there, next minute you find yourself paying £3 to rent it. But while it's there, please check it out and check out the other films that we've been discussing this evening. So thanks to Rich, Steve and Will for joining me and slogging through. It hasn't been the best bunch of films, but it has been an interesting discussion anyway, guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was our friend Josh who once said, you know, I mean, that the worst kind of film to talk about is one which is okay. You know, it's
well, that's kind of where I was. That's kind of where I was with No Man's Land, to be honest. Yeah. That was kind of the most. Yeah. It's fine, kind of uninteresting. Yeah. Whereas something like Vanquish,
you've got stuff to talk about.
So epically wrong in so many ways. It just makes it. A lot more interesting. By the way, if I can just quickly mention on the Vanquish note again, I don't know if you guys had a chance to look at the poster that I sent over, you know, the promotional art for it. Mm-hmm. But it actually says at the time that we're recording this, it said from the director of Bad Boys.
All right.
Which it is not.
No, it really isn't.
It's actually got nothing to do with Michael Bay. And the director hasn't made a different film called Bad Boys. George Gallo wrote he has a story credit on the original Bad Boys.
All right.
And what they've done is they've accidentally said they've misunderstood the marketing team have misunderstood what his role in it was, and they've said from the director of Bad Boys. And I've drawn their attention to it, the distributors, and they might change it.
Not the first time we've had to point out stuff to various distributors as well.
Yeah. They did apologise and say, yeah, you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. That is not true at all. We'll get it changed. But whether it, you know, I don't know how far along, you know, it's supposed to be coming out on DVD and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, how far along are these things? Might not be able to change it. But
this could be one of those sort of like, you know, sort of like a Penny Black where the it's a sort of film where it's going to be like, you know, it's one of those rare copies that says the director of Bad Boy before they
grab a coffee before they get pulled off the shelf because of some sort of because you know they could get I'm sure that they could get like something like that, you know, get done for that because it's not true at all. The original poster that it was adapted from said from the director of, and then it actually had films that George Gallo had made, like The Poison Rose, which was released as Eye for an Eye over here.
We didn't mention his other films, did we? When we talked about.
He did like Eye for, which also had Morgan Freeman. That was we actually liked that one, didn't we?
We did that on our John Travolta special. That was pretty good. Mm. Anyway, don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Twitter at the DTV Digest. We put stuff about new releases and the DTV chart on there, so please check it out. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the DTV shorts. Rich puts out a short every night on the on the Twitter page, and also check out the other podcasts as well, where we look exclusively at a bunch of shorts each episode. Other than that, thank you for listening and tune in next time.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.